This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The waterscape of New Bern transformed early this week. More than a dozen shrimp trawlers pulled up to the New Bern waterfront at Union Point Park. Spectators gathered at the water's edge to view the unusual display. The vessels served as a visual demonstration among commercial fishermen against a proposal that would close much of North Carolina's coastal waters to shrimp trawling.
Gordon Daniels, live in Atlantic, North Carolina. I'm a commercial fisherman, seventh generation, been commercial fishing for over 40 years.
Daniels' 40-foot Harkers Island shrimping boat, the Amy Carroll, is anchored only 100 feet away.
They want to put the shrimp trawlers and the commercial fishermen out of business. And we're here to show support for the commercial fishermen, all commercial fishermen, to try and make the commission understand and deny the petition that they're putting forward today.
On November 2nd, the nonprofit conservation group North Carolina Wildlife Federation submitted a petition to the Marine Fisheries Commission to designate all coastal fishing waters, including the ocean out the 3 miles, not otherwise designated as nursery areas, as special secondary nursery areas. In addition, tow times would be limited to 45 minutes and only during the daytime. As commercial fishermen drag their nets through the water for shrimp, fish are scooped up as well. CEO of the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, Tim Gaswicki, says fishery stocks are diminishing because juvenile fish caught as bycatch aren't able to reproduce.
So the concern is over conservation of juvenile fish and working to get those fish to be afforded the age of spawn. Let them get to maturity to where they're spawning and therefore adding more fish to the stocks for sustainability.
He says the goal of the petition is to balance conservation efforts with current fisheries practices to mitigate the effects of bycatch.
Petition for rulemaking proposal we submitted is simply to look at designating our nursery habitats for juvenile fish over the concern of the amount of bycatch and literally discarded dead fish that has been occurring in North Carolina estuary and waters for way too long.
Bolstering populations of juvenile croaker, spot, and weakfish, he says, would sustain the diversity of the ecosystem and contribute economically to commercial and recreational fishermen in the state. Even though the North Carolina Wildlife Federation points to the shrimping industry as the reason for the decline in juvenile fish, commercial fisherman Gordon Daniels says they're not to blame.
We have put fish excluder devices in our nets. And plus, we put holes in our nets that are not even required. We cut holes in our nets to allow fish to escape. And we've reduced bycatch by almost 40% in just the last few years. And it's not us affecting these fish species.
President of the North Carolina Fisheries Association, Jerry Schill, agrees, citing studies from Sea Grant, the Division of Marine Fisheries, and other academic institutions that show bycatch reduction devices are effective.
And even now, we have a work group that is charged with reducing bycatch even further, and that's showing tremendous success. So what's your reward for being successful? A petition for rulemaking that would devastate the industry. And that's what's so disheartening about the whole process.
North Carolina was the first state to require bycatch reduction devices, or BIRDS. Under the petition, 2 BIRDS would be required on all trawl nets used in coastal fishing waters.
Father, we know that our attitudes sometimes need to change. And today, Lord, maybe it's our attitude.
At 11 o'clock on Tuesday, a second-floor room inside the New Bern Riverfront Convention Center filled with around 200 commercial fishermen and people opposed to the petition. They gathered in solidarity to pray. Schill says if the proposal is approved, it would impose more regulations on an already highly regulated industry and would make it difficult for commercial shrimpers to stay in business.
Amen. This is not a ban on shrimping, technically. But in a couple of years, you'd find out there's no more shrimping in North Carolina because they can't make money.
If the shrimping industry starts to disappear, Schill fears it could have widespread economic repercussions across coastal North Carolina.
And then you start losing your infrastructure. The packers that head the shrimp and grade the shrimp and all that other stuff. And when they start going by the wayside, then you lose your dock facilities because the fish packers sell their property to some condo guys, you know. So it's far reaching in that regard.
The petition for rule change recommends limiting trawling in special secondary nursery areas and internal coastal waters to 3 days per week. Trawling in the Atlantic Ocean would be allowed 4 days per week. Maximum head rope length would be reduced from the current 220 feet to 90 feet in all inshore waters and 110 feet in the ocean. Tim Guestwicke of the North Carolina Wildlife Federation says the proposed changes could benefit fishermen in the long run by bolstering fish stocks and increasing catch size.
We've seen that in other places up and down the East Coast where these rules, if you will, are in place, and certainly the fishing industry is alive and well.
But not everyone's buying it.
I think it's a bunch of shit myself.
Adam Tyler is from Smyrna.
These boys don't do no harm. I'm a commercial fisherman myself. I've worked the war almost all my life, and I've worked around this crowd, and they ain't doing nothing wrong.
Tyler was in New Bern for the public comment meeting held by the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries.
It will devastate the industry. It'll cut the shrimping down. These boys have a hard enough time making it as it is. When you add up the fuel, the gear, the maintenance, and all the other stuff, and you eliminate 2 or 3 days ahead of anybody's work week, how are they going to make it?
By 12:30, more than 1,000 people gathered in the ballroom of the convention center. It was a standing-room-only crowd as 5 advisory committees to the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Commission met to discuss the petition and take comments from the public. So many people were opposed to the petition that the chairman had to stop the hearing, with some 60 people still on the list to speak. Commercial shrimper Alan Crayley works on the fishing vessel Jane Carolyn out of Lowland. He says the Pamlico Sound is their primary spot for trawling.
That's where the shrimp are. That's where they've been. They're trying to say that we're killing the bottom, killing the fisheries, and we ain't killing nothing. The fish are moving north. It's the weather's changing, and they got reports, records of all the fish that were in the sound 5 years ago. They're all north, plentiful, you know what I'm saying?
Even with finfish extruder devices, Crayley says they do catch fish in their nets as bycatch.
Throw it back over. It's alive when we throw it back over, push it right over. Pick the shrimp out and push the fish over. Ain't hurting nothing.
North Carolina Wildlife Federation CEO Tim Guestwicke argues that smaller fish species often don't survive the experience.
When you're hauling and you're trawling and leaving your nets in the water for hours or whatnot, those fish are dead. So when they're talking about bycatch, the vast majority of these juvenile, hundreds of millions of fish over the course of the year, are thrown over as dead, wasted fish. They are not surviving and therefore provide no value to North Carolinians at all.
It seems ideas on fisheries practices will always differ among conservationists and commercial fishermen, but the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries will have the final say-so. After the meeting, 5 advisory committees to the Division of Marine Fisheries announced they rejected the proposal. However, the final verdict won't come until the commission discusses and votes on the petition at their February 15th and 16th business meeting in Wilmington. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Pitt County's rural north end, including Pactolus, Bellhaven, and Bethel, is an especially vulnerable spot for residents, especially in times of need. The area is underserved from a health and wellness standpoint, and chronic patients are prone to repeated visits in the emergency room. A pilot community paramedic program from the county's Emergency Services Department hopes to confront and reduce that problem at the source, and it's scheduled to serve about 20,000 people. It's a nationwide trend that started picking up steam over the past decade. Chris Thomas has more on what the program may offer Pitt County residents.
Late last year, Pitt County received a grant from Vidant Medical Center totaling just over $100,000, with an official check presentation at the Pitt County Board of Commissioners meeting earlier this month. Through that grant, Pitt County EMS Coordinator James MacArthur hopes to take an unconventional approach to emergency care.
We have a paramedic that is out in the community taking referrals from both EMS providers and from hospital discharges, patients that have been seen at the hospital, and reaching out and enrolling them, contacting them, and being proactive.
The program is directed primarily toward patients who have chronic conditions and are repeat visitors to the emergency room in an attempt to save time and money. Some solutions may include things as simple as making sure participants are taking medicine, checking for at-home risks, and other basic actions meant to prevent future 911 calls.
And so if we can help to manage that, that's a really low-hanging fruit that doesn't require a lot of effort and time, that we can hopefully help those people maintain that level of health.
Not unlike other areas in the rural South, the biggest problem for health professionals in Pitt County is fighting high blood pressure and diabetes. MacArthur says average emergency response times to the northern part of the county is about 9 minutes, on par with the rest of the county. But the area targeted by the new program is north of the Tar River. It's prone to flooding, and getting to patients through the area's winding country roads can be especially challenging.
The proportion of those people in the northern part of Pitt County with multiple risk factors for significant illnesses is higher, but part of that is because the population is a little bit, the density is lower. Part of that is also because it's economically, the residents of the northern part of the county tend to be economically challenged a little more, so they have less access to healthcare resources.
The county's search process has begun, and MacArthur hopes to have the position filled by mid-February. But he says there are still some holes that need to be filled before the program is officially rolled out in March, including the community paramedics' requirements and how closely they'll work with the mind as well as the body.
Many law enforcement officers are trained in crisis intervention and crisis awareness. One of the things that's happening in a lot of places, and Wake County has done it with their paramedics, and we are exploring here, is allowing or having our paramedic, and this community paramedic, trained in crisis intervention to be able to work with those folks and hopefully connect them with the right services.
Regardless, local health professionals like Meredith Lovely, the county's paramedic supervisor, are enthusiastic about the project.
What we're hoping, and what we've heard from other counties that are having success with this program, is that it's really going to help alleviate some of the readmissions and the maybe chronic or more frequent calls for these higher at-risk patients.
There are community paramedic programs in Lenoir and Johnston counties, but this would be a first for Pitt County. Lovely is familiar with the target area since she primarily works with the EMS squad in Bethel. It's her hope this will bridge the quality of life gap between the county's urban and rural populations.
I really hope that for the patient's well-being, it helps alleviate that emotional, physical, and financial burden that, all these readmissions and, stuff like that that's creating for them personally.
According to the latest figures from the Kaiser Family Foundation, inpatient care costs at for-profit hospitals in North Carolina are $1,606 per day on average, $586,190 per year. Pam Cowan, nurse administrator at Fidant Medical Center.
So we do look at it from that standpoint of return on investment and reduction in readmissions, reduction in unnecessary emergency department services. And then we look at it in the long term, improve wellness and preventative care. So things like vaccinations, things like advanced directives.
Community paramedic programs are becoming more popular in rural areas that don't have immediate access to medical facilities, like hospitals. But like the program in Pitt County, the nationwide trend is in its earliest stages, and it's too early to tell the overall impact they've had on economically depressed areas. I'm Chris Thomas.
Public Radio East is the media sponsor for the American Music Festival 2017 concert series in Beaufort and Morehead City. The 27th season continues with an homage to legendary cellist Pablo Casals. Cellist Amit Pellet, accompanied by pianist Cassidy Polera, performs a program featuring selections from popular cello works like the Bach First Suite. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the artistic director of the American Music Festival, Barbara McKenzie.
Amit Pellet is not only a gifted cellist, but at 6 foot 5 inches tall, He seems to be both an excellent basketball player and all-around athlete. In your opinion, did his interest in both music and sports increase his sense of discipline on the road to success? And how did he get interested in both music and sports?
Well, Amit grew up on the kibbutz, and I'm sure playing basketball was something that was just a very natural pastime. And he really could have been in the draft as a professional player. But he got distracted by a young lady and had a big crush on her. And she was a musician. I think he felt like if he played a musical instrument, he could get her attention. So that's the story he tells. And so he picked up the cello, and the rest is history. He was just a natural cellist. And you know, he's one of the most disciplined artists I've known in my career.
Amit's talents as a musician must be truly exceptional, especially if he won the trust of Pablo Casals' widow named Marta. Now, tell me the story about how they met, and how did Amit receive permission to perform with Casals' 1733 Goffredo cello?
Well, I believe it started, she had heard of Amit, and after a while she invited him to her apartment in New York, and she wanted him to play for her. And he tells the story that after he performed for her, they talked, and then she presented him with Casals' cello and said, "You are the one to bring this back to life again." And of course, you know, for any musician, being handed the precious or historic instrument of a great artist like Casals would be pretty intimidating. And he has a lot of humility, but I think he really is such an exceptional performer, and the cello, that he's just such a deep artist, you know, he plays with such passion and heart, and I'm sure that's what attracted her to that idea of giving him Casals' cello.
Now, the program on January 28th features a whole range of composers from the 18th century to the 20th century, from Johann Sebastian Bach to Schubert, David Popper out of the late 19th century, and a Soviet-era composer out of the mid-20th century.
The program starts with the Bach, and Casals discovered those unaccompanied Bach suites. And he was the first to perform them as a set, and he was the first to record them. And that cello that folks will hear that Amit is performing on Saturday evening is the very same cello that Casals used when he did those historic recordings of the Bach suites, which is really fascinating to think about that because, you know, that recording basically, and Casals, is credited with elevating the position of the cello to a real solo concert solo instrument. I mean, it had been used in concertos and as a solo instrument, but not, you know, like the violin or the piano. And Casals' recordings and his artistry really propelled the cello into the limelight.
So in your opinion, then, this timeline of the program does give an accurate historical depiction of how important the cello is in classical music throughout the years?
Yes, I think that program, so this program is one that Casals himself would have performed. And so, you know, he starts with the Bach, and then we have the Soviet era Sitsadze, it's a tricky name to pronounce, the Soviet composer, which is a very light set of dance themes. And then we have the beautiful Franz Schubert, the Arpeggioni Sonata, and then David Popper, which Popper was a cellist, and all of his music for cello is very virtuoso. So I'm sure that's just going to be the little cherry on top after a full course.
And the American Music Festival, once again, will be held Saturday, January 28th at 8 p.m. at the History Museum of Carteret County in Morehead City, formerly the History Place. And for more information, you can check out the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Barbara, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downey Journal.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Mary Jo Heath. Join me Saturday for a live matinee broadcast of Gounod's Romeo and Juliet from the Metropolitan Opera, starring Diana Damrau and Vittorio Grigolo. The pair recently thrilled Met audiences with their sensuous, charged performances in Massenet's Manon. Now they bring their passion to the stage as the young lovers in Shakespeare's greatest tragedy, with Gounod's score capturing their rapture and despair. Gianandrea Nozzetta conducts the Met Orchestra in a new production by Tony Award-winning director Bartlett Scheer. During intermission, meet the stars in an interview conducted by Live in HD host Eileen Perez. Don't miss Saturday's broadcast of Romeo and Juliet, live on the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network.
The opera Saturday afternoon at 1 on PRE, Public Radio East, Classical.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. The seed catalogs are pouring in, and it's easy to get caught up in the excitement. But before you start placing your order, I want you to take the following thoughts into consideration. First, read the label and do a little research about your crop and determine whether the seeds will need an early start indoors. Cool season crops like broccoli and cabbage benefit from being started indoors, so they are large enough to be transplanted out in the garden. Our warm weather crops like tomatoes and peppers need to be started under lights inside, so they're ready to go out in the garden when the soil has warmed up and the last frost is past. If you aren't up for starting your own seedlings indoors, you will want to wait and buy these plants as transplants. Vegetable crops that grow best when they're directly seeded in the garden include vining crops like beans and peas, root crops like radishes and carrots, and corn. Next, you'll want to determine how much seed you need to buy. It's okay if you buy a little extra seed. Fast-growing vegetables like lettuce, radish, spinach, and beans can be planted several times throughout the season. And if you have extras, many seeds store well from year to year, but it's best to buy pea and onion seeds fresh each season. You'll want to consider your space. If you have a small garden, avoid space-hogging vegetables like sweet corn, pumpkins, and watermelon. Instead, focus on higher-yielding, more compact vegetables like leafy greens, tomatoes, beans, herbs, and peppers. For even more compact plants, look for varieties that are listed as bush, dwarf, patio, or that indicate that they are good for containers. Now, I know that many people are concerned about GMO seeds. Just remember that there are no GMO seeds that are currently easily marketed to homeowners. You aren't going to accidentally buy them while cruising through your favorite homeowner seed catalogs. You will want to look for disease-resistant varieties, especially if you have had problems in your garden in the past. Most varieties are not resistant to all diseases, just to some. In our area, tomato spotted wilt virus and nematodes are common problems for tomatoes. So look for varieties that are resistant to those problems. However, we don't have any readily available varieties that are resistant to southern bacterial wilt. So if this disease has been a problem in your garden, you will want to move your tomatoes to a new location or consider growing them in containers in a clean potting mix. While you're checking out the different varieties, make sure you check the days to harvest information for each variety as well. In our long growing season, a mix of short, mid, and long season varieties will extend your harvest window without multiple planting dates. You will want to include some flowers in your planting plan as well. Flowers add color and interest to the garden, while serving as an important source of nectar and pollen for the pollinator insects in your garden, as well as the beneficial predatory insects that feed on the insects that cause problems. So sit back, enjoy reading all of your seed catalogs, develop your wish list, and start coming up with a plan for this year's garden, because it's time to start ordering some seeds.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.